All right, welcome back, everyone.
I am really excited about today's topic, but before I dive into that, there's a couple of things I just want to go over with all of you that I want to put at the front end of the episode to make sure that you listen to it, as opposed to getting to the end where you start to tune out. First things first, if you need to reach me, my email is in the show notes. Please use that email. It's the one for West Wellness, which is my consulting company. If you try to reach me through the Peptique or go through our customer service email at the Peptique, I cannot respond to that legally. Those are two totally separate things. That's all through West Wellness. I cannot answer those questions. And if I want to keep the Peptique going and able to offer all the amazing products and peptides that have been life-changing for me and a lot of you listening, then I really ask that you not reach out through the Peptique about those types of questions. It's kind of separation of church and state, if you will. So I'm not being rude if I don't respond or if my customer service team responds and says we can't answer these questions, because legally they can't. And so that's why that's happening. And for some reason, it's just been happening a lot lately. So I wanted to throw that out there to all of you. We are in just such a weird space right now with all of this. And I'm a little nervous about even talking about any of this on the podcast, but I feel like it's important to let y'all know as well. This last week, we got our credit card processing shut down. And a lot of you have been asking why. Now we have a workaround and we're looking for a long-term solution. But I kind of want to talk about what that means so you have an understanding. If you go to a lot of research peptide companies, you will see that they don't offer credit card processing at all. You'll see Zelle or ACH or cryptocurrencies, things like that. I really wanted to stay away or still want to stay away from cryptocurrencies. Who knows if that is going to be a thing for the Peptique in the future? It very well could be, but for right now, we're not doing that. We are using Zelle. But what has happened is that the research peptide world is looked at as high risk for credit card processors. And this is where Big Pharma kind of has their fingers and hands into everything. And it's not about like them having these conspiratorial meetings or something like that, but it's more about financial gravity. So if you look at it this way, that these big pharmaceutical companies are among the largest clients of banks, payment processors, and card networks. So they spend billions annually on advertising, lobbying, and compliance. They operate fully inside FDA-approved patent-protected frameworks, where research peptide companies, they challenge the traditional drug pipeline, are relatively inexpensive, off-patent, are naturally occurring, and they reduce dependence on long-term pharmaceuticals in a lot of cases, which is the whole point of them. It's why they're so awesome. So from a financial standpoint, Big Pharma is low risk, high revenue, predictable. Peptides are high risk, lower margin, unpredictable. And so they have thrown every peptide company into a high risk category, which means you cannot get processing at all. So it's been a big problem and we've been able to work around it, but I knew our time was limited on that. And this happened last week. Like I said, we are still able to process credit cards, but we're having to find a longer term solution, which means it's going to be very expensive in order to keep credit card processing up. So, in full disclosure, I just want you to be prepared that we're probably going to have to tag on a processing fee to use a credit card. We are working out the numbers right now because we want to keep that as low as possible for each and every one of you. Could mean a very small increase in the products. So we can try to offset some of the costs and absorb the rest and offer a larger discount for using Zelle or an ACH payment sort of thing. I'm trying to figure out the details on that as well. So whatever increase that might be occurring, if you can use Zelle, it will offset that increase. And most of the time you're using some sort of discount code anyway. Hopefully that will help with that and not really affect your pocketbook as much, but can also keep the Peptique up and going in a way that can still provide you all these amazing things. And we have all these amazing things coming, but I didn't want to just throw this stuff out there and then y'all get online and be like, what the heck is happening? So I wanted to be really transparent about that. I think that's it for the big stuff. It's unfortunate that so many hurdles are put in our way that impede our ability to make health and wellness decisions for ourselves. And I continue to be highly frustrated by all the regulatory things. I think I mentioned this last week, like Hunter Williams, who is a big peptide guy. If you listen to me, you probably listen to him. And he got all of his, he got his YouTube taken down. He got his social media taken down. And I'm just like, why is it not okay for us to talk about these things? And so that's why I'm a little hesitant to even talk about this here, but I'm just going to anyway. So here we go. And when I was thinking about today's topic, I've been really experimenting with some of the neuropeptides and having really good success with some of them and some of them not so much, but I was going back and forth on which one do I want to talk about. I find them all so fascinating for different reasons. And I decided today to talk about oxytocin. One of the reasons why I wanted to put oxytocin first is because of the great response from y'all when we added it to the product line. And I thought, this is something that people are using and more than likely want to know more about, or maybe you've been thinking about it and don't know how to use it or exactly what it's for. And when I started using it myself and doing all the research for it and then even doing more research for this podcast, it's amazing how far-reaching it is. So we're going to dive into all of that today. One of the things I want to say up front about any neuropeptide, any peptide in general, but this is one that you definitely want to be a little bit careful about because we're talking about a neuropeptide and hormone that impacts our brain chemistry, that sort of thing. And so anytime we're talking about that, you definitely want to do your own research and understand where you are at with this little disclaimer. This is my experience. This is for informational and educational purposes only. I am not encouraging you to go buy, use any of that, but I definitely want to bring you the information so you can go do your research. You can go talk to your health and wellness professional, whoever that might be, and make an informed educational decision on your own. All right. Enough with that. So let's dive in. One of the things I want to be clear, because I got this question and I think it's valid, because I think a lot of people, when they hear oxytocin, they think Oxycontin. These are entirely two different things. Oxycontin is a highly addictive drug that most of you have heard about and terrible side effects, and shouldn't even be allowed in the marketplace any longer, but that's a different topic for a different day. These are two totally different things and not the same thing at all. But I think you hear that oxy in front of it and then you immediately think, ooh, this is bad. So I wanna have a little clarifier there that we're not talking about the same thing here. But oxytocin is actually called the love hormone or the bonding hormone. Or in the research space, you'll hear it as the snuggle peptide, okay? Because it makes you wanna snuggle with people. But that description really barely scratches the surface of what oxytocin actually does in the body. And at its core, it's a neuropeptide and a hormone produced in the hypothalamus and released by the pituitary gland. So it acts as both a chemical messenger in the brain and a signaling molecule throughout the body. So most people first hear about oxytocin in the context of childbirth, breastfeeding, or emotional bonding. And yes, it absolutely plays a role there, but oxytocin's influence goes far beyond reproduction and relationships. The only, at least to my knowledge, I could be wrong about this, the only FDA-approved use of it is for childbirth. So Pitocin, to induce childbirth, that's what's given, and that is the synthetic form of oxytocin. And I remember when I was giving birth to Logan, when he was 23 years ago, I was indeed very different than Maddie, my firstborn. That was more of a traumatic experience. But with him, I was induced and it was a very pleasurable experience. And I remember afterwards saying to my husband, who laughed at me, I was like, oh, I could totally do that again, like immediately after I had him. And looking back, knowing what I know now, I definitely think that is a large part to the Pitocin I was given. But also after you have childbirth, you naturally produce more of it, which gives you that intense bonding that most of us feel right after we have our children, right? So it actually frames how we feel and experience pain and can signal the pain in a different way. So you think, oh, that wasn't so bad. And we're going to dive a little bit into that It's why we, most of us, end up having more than one child, okay? So oxytocin helps regulate how safe we feel, how connected we feel, and even how our nervous system responds to stress. So from a physiological standpoint, oxytocin is deeply involved in social bonding and trust, emotional regulation, stress modulation, nervous system balance, pain perception, and even inflammation signaling. So when oxytocin levels are adequate and responsive, the body tends to shift more from that parasympathetic, that rest and connect state. This is opposite of being stuck in that fight or flight mode that we so often find ourselves in. So that's why oxytocin isn't just about romantic connection, it's about resilience. It helps buffer the stress response by counteracting cortisol and dampening overactivation of the brain's fear center. And this is one reason it's being researched in areas like anxiety, social stress, and nervous system dysregulation. So another important thing to understand is that oxytocin is context dependent. It doesn't just make you feel good automatically. Instead, it amplifies social cues and emotional perception. So in the right environment, this supports that connection, calm, trust. And in the wrong environment, or when the nervous system is already really dysregulated, it can feel very different. It's not just an emotional hormone. Like I said earlier, it's a regulatory peptide. So it communicates between the brain and the immune system and the autonomic nervous system. And that's why researchers are continuing to explore it more and more. So in this episode, we're going to move beyond the love hormone label and really unpack what oxytocin actually does in the body, why some people feel calmer and more connected with it, while others may feel a little overstimulated, who may benefit from it, who may not, how it fits into the broader peptide and nervous system optimization conversation. And of course, we're going to talk about my experience dosing and all of that. Okay, but let's start with why people often go to oxytocin in the research peptide world. Because it's mainly to improve connection and our sex life. And that is the real drive that I see when people start to play around and experiment with it. And oxytocin plays a major role in sexual intimacy, emotional closeness, and pair bonding. It does this through very real, measurable biological mechanisms. During things like physical touch, kissing, orgasm, or even prolonged eye contact, oxytocin is released in the brain. And this helps lower stress hormones like cortisol and increase feelings of trust, safety, and emotional openness. So from a sexual health standpoint, it can help enhance emotional connection during and after sex, increase feelings of closeness and bonding with your partner. It can support relaxation and nervous system downshifting after orgasm and improve sexual satisfaction by deepening emotional presence. So this is one reason why sex just doesn't feel good physically. It often feels emotionally grounding for a lot of people. So oxytocin is acting as a bridge between the body and the brain. And here's where that conversation usually stops and where it shouldn't. Because oxytocin isn't just released because of connection. It actually creates the internal conditions that allow the connection to actually happen. So scientifically, oxytocin modulates activity in the part of the brain responsible for fear, threat, detection, and emotional guarding. So when oxytocin is active, the brain becomes less defensive and more receptive. So in simple terms, it can help your body feel safe enough to open up. And this matters enormously for sex and intimacy, especially for women, and especially in times of stress, hormonal imbalance, or nervous system overload. So when someone is stuck in that fight or flight, their body is prioritizing survival, not pleasure. Desire drops and arousal becomes harder and emotional presence feels forced. And I think most women, if you're to a certain age, can say that they've experienced that. I'm sure men do too. I'm not a man, so I'm speaking from personal experience and experience working with women and then talking to all my girlfriends over the years that this is a real thing that is a struggle. So oxytocin helps shift the nervous system out of survival mode into parasympathetic receptive state where intimacy, pleasure, and connection actually becomes possible. So this is why oxytocin is often studied not just for libido and orgasm, but for low desire linked to stress, burnout, difficulty feeling emotionally connected during sex, postpartum intimacy changes, trauma-related sexual shutdown, relationship disconnection that isn't psychological but more physiological. And here's something else that most people don't realize. Oxytocin works differently depending on the context and the nervous system state. It doesn't override emotional disconnection. It amplifies what's already there. So in a safe, supportive environment, it deepens trust and closeness. In an unsafe or dysregulated state, for some people, it can actually heighten emotional awareness, which may not be a bad thing, again, depending on what your goals are. So it's about restoring that biological foundation that allows intimacy to feel natural again. And let's be real, right? Because in life, between work, kids, all the different stressors, financial stress, physical stress, emotional stress, I hear from women every day that just say they feel burned out, they have no desire, that they love their partner but just don't have the desire anymore. And this is where oxytocin can come in and really make it different, okay? So this is the main reason why I often get questions or have people come to me and ask me about oxytocin. And this is a really good segue into how it works with cortisol and the nervous system, because we know that cortisol plays a huge role in how well we age, how our hormones perform, how we sleep, how we recover, what our energy levels are, if we're able to maintain healthy weight, etc. So how do oxytocin and cortisol interact with each other? And just like everything else fun, oxytocin declines as we age. And so this is part of the reason, from even a longevity standpoint, why I think it's important to have this conversation. But to understand oxytocin, we have to understand the nervous system, and especially relative to cortisol. So cortisol is the body's main stress hormone. Its job is to keep us alert, responsive, protected. In short bursts, cortisol is helpful and necessary. But when stress becomes chronic, cortisol stays elevated. That keeps the nervous system stuck in that sympathetic fight or flight state. And when the body is in this state, it prioritizes survival over regulation, digestion slows, sleep becomes lighter, inflammation increases, emotional regulation becomes harder, and connection, both emotional and physical, starts to feel effortful. It feels so much harder and not like this natural thing that maybe used to come to you really easily. That's not to be considered psychological weakness. That's your nervous system physiology. Now enters oxytocin, and oxytocin is the neuropeptide that signals safety. It helps calm activity in the brain's threat detection center and supports shift again towards this parasympathetic nervous system where the body can rest, repair, and regulate. So here's a simple way to think about this. Cortisol keeps the body alert. Oxytocin helps the body feel safe enough to relax. So when oxytocin is active, cortisol output decreases, heart rate variability improves, the nervous system becomes more flexible, emotional reactivity softens, and the body becomes more receptive to rest and recovery. So this is why people often feel calmer after genuine connection, physical touch, being emotionally understood, or even things like deep breathing and mindfulness practices. All of these stimulate oxytocin pathways. But the relationship works both ways, because chronically elevated cortisol can dull oxytocin signaling. So when someone is constantly stressed or underslept, inflamed, or emotionally overloaded, the nervous system becomes a lot less responsive to oxytocin, even when safety or connection is present. This can show up as feeling tired but wired, difficulty relaxing, even in calm environments, emotional numbness or irritability, poor sleep despite exhaustion, reduced tolerance for touch or closeness. This is where sexual desire can be affected too, but it's a downstream consequence, not the root issue. The root issue is the nervous system overload. So oxytocin doesn't override the stress. It actually works best after cortisol is reduced. So supporting oxytocin isn't about forcing calm or connection. It's about lowering the baseline stress response so the nervous system can actually recognize safety again, because regulation comes before connection and safety always comes before heat. So I think that's something that, again, I see a lot of women who come to me and their cortisol is just erratic or super high. And so I'm not saying that you can't take this if you have a lot of cortisol dysregulation, but it's probably not going to fix the issue. The key is to try to work to get that down. And then you can supplement, if you will, with the oxytocin to get even a better response. Although I will talk to you about ways that I've used it a little bit later. And then you can make your own decision. Another area where oxytocin gets almost no attention is pain, especially chronic pain and neuroinflammation. So most people think of pain as a structural issue, a bad joint, an injury, inflammation in the tissue. But pain is actually processed in the brain and the nervous system. And that means that the state of the nervous system matters just as much as the source of pain itself. So when the nervous system is under chronic stress, inflammatory signaling in the brain increases. And the microglial cells, these are the immune cells of the nervous system, become overactive. So these pain pathways become more sensitive. So in simple terms, the volume knob on pain gets turned up. And this is where oxytocin becomes super interesting because it's been shown to play a role in modulating pain perception and calming neuroinflammatory signaling. It doesn't act like a painkiller that blocks sensation, but instead it helps reduce central sensitization. And this is the process where the brain amplifies pain signals even when tissue damage is minimal. So oxytocin communicates differently with pain processing regions of the brain, including the spinal cord, limbic system, and it kind of helps quiet exaggerated threat responses, if you will. So when oxytocin signaling is adequate, pain thresholds increase, inflammatory signaling in the nervous system decreases, muscle guarding and tensions soften, and the brain becomes less reactive to that sensory input. Super fascinating, right? This is why pain often feels worse during periods of emotional stress, poor sleep, nervous system overload, and why it can also feel temporarily better when people feel safe, supported, or deeply relaxed. Again, this isn't psychological, it's neuroimmune communication. So just like with cortisol, the relationship goes both ways. Chronic neuroinflammation and ongoing pain can suppress oxytocin signaling. And over time, the nervous system becomes locked into a protective, hypervigilant state where pain becomes the default signal. This can show up in ways like widespread or unexplained pain, heightened sensitivity to touch or pressure, pain that flares with stress, migraines or tension headaches, pain that persists despite normal imaging. All these are ways that this can show up. And oxytocin doesn't fix damaged tissues. Let me be clear about that. But it can help regulate the brain's response to pain. So this is why researchers are exploring oxytocin and think neuropathic pain, fibromyalgia, post-injury pain that lingers, and inflammatory and stress-related pain syndromes. So the goal isn't to numb the pain. The goal is to help the nervous system stop overreacting to it. Because when the brain feels safe, pain no longer needs to shout to be heard. All right? So we've talked about a lot of different ways, even ways that probably a lot of you haven't thought of, that oxytocin can be beneficial, but who's a good candidate for it? Because this is not a universal solution, and it's not something everyone should just jump into without understanding their nervous system state. So oxytocin tends to be most supportive for people whose nervous systems are overactivated but not shut down. So this includes individuals who feel chronically stressed or on edge, have difficulty relaxing, even when life is calm, experience emotional hypervigilance or anxiety patterns, have stress-amplified pain or tension, struggle with connection because their systems won't downshift. And let me tell you, he's super transparent and a little bit vulnerable here. This is me. This is literally describing me. I do feel chronically stressed all the time. I'm so used to it that I don't know anything different. So it feels very normal to me. My brain is just always going a million miles a minute. Not necessarily a bad thing. I just tend to have a really hard time slowing down, shutting things down. I don't have stress, amplified pain, or tension that I'm aware of. So nothing's glaring there. But I do struggle with connection because my system won't downshift because I'm constantly go. And to stop and try to have a connection sometimes feels like it's impeding my go, which I know sounds terrible, but again, I said I was being vulnerable here. But it is. It's okay. Just get out of my way. I'll come back to you in a minute. I need to do that. And then I can calm down. So it's not meant to not be in connection. It's just my nervous system is constantly in fight or flight. And it's the only way I know how to be. So I can actually super relate to this. But who may not be a good candidate? If you have profound fatigue or burnout, you have emotional numbness or flatness or very low motivation or drive, you're feeling disconnected rather than more of that anxious disconnection, symptoms that may be worse with stimulation rather than improved, this may not be a good fit for you. You may need to try to get all those things regulated before you do try that. You may not like the outcome that you get. And this doesn't mean that oxytocin is bad. It just means that your nervous system might not be in the right state to respond to it in an effective way. And in fact, you might have an adverse outcome for it. My ask would be that you would really sit down and question, where are you at with these things? Is your nervous system ready for it? Remember, it's not creating that safe, connective state. If your body is able to receive it, it can help induce it and signal it at a higher level, all right? So when it's used thoughtfully in the right context, it can be a very powerful tool for regulation and connection. Okay, but before we move out of that and into the dosing, I do want to talk about oxytocin and medication interactions, because this is one that I get, a question I get a lot, because again, this is, we're talking about a neuropeptide here. And let me say this, I am not a doctor, I'm not a nurse. I'm just telling you about what I know and what the science says. But if you are taking some of these things that we're going to talk about, and then I would highly recommend talking to your healthcare provider before just starting this, because the truth is, I can read these things, study these things all day long, but from a real world perspective, it can look very different, okay? So oxytocin itself doesn't have any known classic drug interactions the way many medications do, but it does interact with the same brain systems when you're talking about antidepressants, anti-anxieties, things like that. And the distinction matters because oxytocin works primarily through the central nervous system, influencing or involves rather in emotional regulation, threat perception, and social processing. Many anxiety and antidepressant medications act on these same pathways just through different mechanisms. So for example, the SSRIs and the SNRIs, which affect serotonin and norepinephrine, can indirectly influence oxytocin signaling. In some people, this may actually enhance oxytocin responsiveness. In others, it can blunt emotional range, which may make oxytocin feel less noticeable. Benzodiazepines like Xanax, Ativan, Klonopin, these suppress the nervous system activity more broadly. So someone is relying heavily on these medications, oxytocin may feel muted or inconsistent because the brain is already being pharmacologically dampened. Mood stabilizers or antipsychotic medications can also alter how emotional signaling is processed, which may change how oxytocin is perceived. Not necessarily dangerous, but unpredictable. This doesn't mean oxytocin is contraindicated. It just means that context matters. And oxytocin tends to amplify emotional awareness. So medications that are intended to blunt or heavily control emotional signaling can change how that amplification is experienced. And there's also a few other medication categories worth mentioning. People taking blood pressure medications, because it does have a nitric oxide release, which is a vasodilator. Medications that affect heart rate. Certain pain medications are medications that strongly affect dopamine. May notice subtle shifts in how oxytocin feels, particularly around calmness, motivation, emotional sensitivity, things like that. Again, it's not about direct interaction. It's about overlapping nervous system effects. So this is why oxytocin isn't something to stack casually or without awareness of the bigger picture. The most important takeaway is this. It's not sedating like a typical anti-anxiety, and it's not like a typical anti-anxiety medication, and it's not stimulating like an antidepressant. It's regulatory. And when the nervous system is already being strongly influenced by medications, adding another regulatory signal needs to be approached very thoughtfully. And that's why education on this, low and slow approaches, professional guidance, especially for someone that's on these types of medications, really does matter, because you don't want to override the system. You want to support it safely, all right? Okay, let's get into goods, what all of you want to know. Let's talk about the dosing, and I'll talk to you about my experience after that. A couple things to be aware of is, again, this is a signaling peptide, and when you're talking about a signaling peptide, you want to make sure that you go very low and slow so you're not overstimulating your body to do too much of something. Also want to be careful about how long you take this because it can dull the body's natural receptors to this. We don't want to do this. We see this in the growth hormones. So I personally use it as needed. I don't use it every day. If you really are feeling like you need a nervous system reset, I would say you could use this for a couple of weeks, see how you respond to it, but then you really want to get off of it. This is not one you want to stay on very long at all. If you're loving the outcome that you're getting from it, then you can get that reset and use it as needed. Now, one of the questions I get is that it is common to take this one intranasally. I personally did not get any benefit from that. I never have, even with some of the other peptides like Celanc and Cimax, things like that. I did not get any big benefit from that intranasally either. So that just may be a me thing and how my body responds to those things. I definitely felt an impact when I took this sub-Q injection, okay? I'm not saying don't try the intranasal form, but for today's episode of Prodosing, I'm talking about the injectable form, all right? And remember, low and slow is your friend on this. You do not have to worry about timing. It can have a relaxing effect, but doesn't make you drowsy. And so you don't need to worry about that. There are two side effects that I did have from it, because I think I started on too high of a dose. We'll talk about that in just a minute. Is I got a massive headache. Nothing that ibuprofen couldn't, you know, wipe out for me, but you still taking ibuprofen consistently is very hard on your system and not something you want to do. So I did have to take ibuprofen after the first time I took it, and you get this intense flushing. So it starts in your chest and goes up your neck into your face area, and you feel like a little bit like you're on fire. Never had a hot flash, but I would say that's got to be what a hot flash feels like. I turned a beet red. It is super fast. It comes on 10 seconds, and then 10 seconds it goes away. But the first time you take it, especially if you did what I did and took too high of a dose, so you need to listen to me when I'm telling you this, it was real intense. I was like, whoa. And so the dosing for me, or that I would recommend in general, is start between 20 mcgs. That's not a mistake. 20 micrograms, so 20 mcgs to 50 mcgs. My sweet spot for me is around 30 to 40. 50 tends to be a little too much. Although, and when I was doing my research for all this, I was reading a lot of people saying that they got up to 100 to 150 mcg. That is not something I would recommend, but your body does get used to it. So I started at 50. That was too high. I went down to 20, then did 30, then did 40. I haven't done 50 again, but the benefit that I got off the 30 and 40 was strong enough where I don't feel like I need to take it again. For me, it really did just get my mind out of that fight or flight mode. It calmed me down. It allowed me the ability to want to feel connected. When I've used it in times where my husband and I were going to go out on a date or something like that. And I knew that I was in that hypervigilant state or really wound up. And I knew in order to give 100% of me to him in that moment, I needed to calm down. And this helped me do that and get my nervous system to a place where I was truly able to just really connect in a really positive, beautiful way. And it really did work for me. I will be doing some podcasts on some of the neuropeptides in the near future that didn't work well for me. So it's not a one size fits all. You definitely want to play around with it and see what works best for you. But I definitely love having this in my arsenal for those types of moments. The other thing I will say is there's a reason why we only carry the 2 milligram vials of this. It's a very volatile peptide. So it degrades quicker and easier than a lot of them. And if you're only taking 20 to 50 micrograms, if you get a 10 milligram vial, it's going to get wasted. So we intentionally decided on 2 milligram vials. So it keeps the cost down and you're not being wasteful of the products. And I'm trying to remember because I think last week's episode, I forgot some of the dosing stuff. And I got a lot of questions. What about this? What about that? I was like, oh my goodness, I totally did not include that in the episode. And so I think that covers everything. But reach out to me with your questions. I'm happy to answer them as always. And go to the show notes for my email. Use the email there. Do not contact me directly through the website, as noted earlier. If you're a woman and you want to talk about all things longevity, health related, peptide related, hormone related, join the Women's Peptide Collective. There's a link in the show notes for that. It's a wonderful group of ladies. I learn so much from all of you every day. I'm so grateful for all of you out there that are part of that group. Go like the podcast, share the podcast. That helps me continue to be able to do what I'm doing. And just stay with me on this roller coaster ride of the research peptide world. There is a link in the show note that you can include your email. So if everything gets shut down, I am able to reach out to all of you to let you know what's going on, because that's a real possibility. A lot of things that are going on right now make this space a little more volatile than usual. And what else? A little reminder that the oxytocin for the people that it works for, it's great. I read a lot of the different forums and stuff about how people hated it or had bad reactions to it. I didn't love it the first time I took it. So I had to play around with it and find the right dose for me that actually now I'm a giant raging fan of it. And so don't just give up if you take it one time and you don't like the reaction. Lower the dose a little, or if you don't get any reaction at all, maybe raise the dose a little. But you kind of have to play around with this stuff a little bit to figure out what's going to work best for you. So I will leave on that note. And until next time, have a blessed day.